Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby. Joining me is Claire White.
Hello.
And it is freaking hot outside. And it's Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We're here to discuss new nerd creations, not the weather, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. We can talk about the weather if we want, though.
Yes, I'm sure everyone will be super interested in it.
Super interested. It's really... So here's your options. We can talk about the weather, or we can talk about Starz' new show, American Gods.
I think American Gods would be infinitely more interesting. And we might be able to talk about the weather in American Gods.
That's true. It does have a very weather-filled cover. The book does.
Yeah.
American Gods is a new show from Starz that is based on the Neil Gaiman novel of the same name. The novel was published in 2001, and the show's first episode was released on April 30th of this year. Brian Fuller and Michael Green are the showrunners, and they definitely have kind of a Benioff and Weiss kind of feel.
Game of Thrones the, show creator.
Game of Thrones showrunners, yes. So I think we'll get into that in opinions. I definitely want to address it. American Gods follows Shadow, a recently released convict, and his involvement in a metaphysical war between new and old gods in America. The book and show focus a lot on immigration, Americana, homogenization of culture, and the small forgotten towns of the American Midwest and South. American Gods stars Ricky Whittle as Shadow and Ian McShane as Mr. Wednesday.
Mr. Wednesday.
And if you know who if you know what Wednesday is, you'll know who Mr. Wednesday is. Claire's going to be talking about history and history of immigration in America, I believe.
A history of American culture and why people would immigrate to America.
It goes back to that theme of homogenization of culture.
Yes.
Cool. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about the show and a lot about Neil Gaiman, because I love Neil Gaiman.
Neil Gaiman's really cool.
Yeah.
His work is, at least.
Yeah. So Claire, why don't you take it away?
Okay. So while reading the book and watching the TV show, I got the sense that as much as Gaiman was exploring other cultures, you know, he is talking about gods that have come from all over the world brought by immigrants to America, what he's really exploring here was America. Examples are that the main characters drive through the American Midwest, stopping at uniquely American points, like, for example, the exact center of the country. They eat American food at diners. They stop at small American towns throughout their trip. So I was looking up interviews with Gaiman, and just to put it out there, he's British, and he lives in America, so I feel he has a very unique perspective on America. And Gaiman said he believes that America eats other cultures, and that in America, everything homogenizes. And he wanted to talk about how rough edges get knocked off very quickly, at least as far as immigrant traditions and cultures, and that things that make them special, these cultures and traditions, or unique, get forgotten or lost to the American dream.
That's interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
So, as you mentioned earlier, the book focuses on gods that were brought to America by immigrants, and for the most part, are forgotten within a generation, if even a generation. And in Gaiman's book, American Gods, these people are instead worshiping the gods of technology and media instead of what they came worshiping. So I started off wanting to research Americana. I was telling you earlier when we were talking about what we were going to do for this episode, what makes America so great that these immigrants would be lured to it, and what parts of American culture would they adopt, and how would that happen with their own culture? This led me down a research rabbit hole, like you do. And actually, I found myself focusing on the American dream instead. And instead of finding the appeal in the American things, like aspects of American culture, I actually started looking in how do we define American culture? How would that lure someone in?
When I was a kid, I thought, when I found out that they don't have peanut butter in Europe, they use something else called Nutella, and I didn't know what that was. I thought people came to America almost purely for peanut butter.
Probably.
You think so?
No. I think it's one of the many gifts given to people by America.
Thanks for humoring me, Claire.
Anytime, Kyle. So I want to start off with some basic facts about America. The United States is the third largest country in the world, and as of 2015, the population is estimated to be around 320 million. It's also one of the most diverse countries. I'll get to counties in a second. Countries in the world. The U.S. Census Bureau estimates that there are more than 300 languages spoken in the U.S., and nearly every known religion is practiced in the U.S. Now, just some fun facts. We're recording this episode in Queens County, which, according to a 2014 Atlantic article, is the third most diverse county in the U.S. Do you know what the first two most diverse counties are? And I'll give you a hint. They're in the same state.
Well, a recent article that was passed around my friends and family, because I'm from Maryland, says that Montgomery County is the number one most diverse county in America now.
Oh, see, I'm taking a 2014 article. So it wasn't anywhere in Maryland.
I'd assume Brooklyn,
no.
Kings County. No?
No. In 2014, this was the first two were the Aleutians West Census Area and the Aleutians East Borough, both in Alaska.
Wow. The Aleutian Islands are the most diverse?
Well, they're small populations and oil industry is coming in. So they think it's luring all kinds of different people there because of the growing industry.
Yeah.
Also, really fun fact that has really nothing to do with what I'm talking about. The fifth most diverse county in the U.S., according to this 2014 article, was Solano County, which is where I'm from in California.
Well, Claire, Montgomery County has you beat now, according to something that was passed around on Facebook, probably BuzzFeed. It's legit. Don't worry about it.
We'll have to double check this later. I'll link to the Atlantic article on the Facebook page, though. So now that we know that I come from one of the most diverse counties in the United States and we live in one of the most diverse counties in the United States, I want to talk about the American dream and what the definition is. James Trislow Adams was the first person to use the phrase American dream in his book, Epic of America. And these are his words. The American dream is that dream of a land in which life should be better and richer and fuller for everyone, with opportunity for each according to ability or achievement. He goes on to say, a dream of motor cars and high wages merely, but a dream of social order in which each man and each woman shall be able to attain the fullest stature of which they are innately capable and recognized by others for what they are, regardless of the fortuitous circumstances of birth or position.
Do you know when that book came out? Like around what era that was?
It was the 1930s.
Okay. Oh, during the Depression, huh?
Yeah. And if you look back, most other cultures historically have believed that individuals are parts of the social whole. So their roles are determined by God or fate or those who rank above them or all of the above.
Yeah.
And so this did make the American perspective very unique.
We're special.
We're very special.
And we will never forget it. And we will not stop rubbing it in your faces, rest of the world.
Our founding fathers put into the Declaration of Independence that Americans are entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, the pursuit of happiness is a big deal. It means that each free person's desire to pursue happiness was not just petty self-indulgence. And historians argue that it set up a society where the population was aspiring for a better life, as opposed to other societies where you're just part of the cog in the machine.
Yeah.
And because of this, America began as a very unusually individualistic society. Free men in early America stressed attaining the independence that came with having enough property to support a household. And that was a pretty novel idea for the average everyday farmer. Now, Americans, for the most part, believe that each person is a sovereign individual, unique, independent, self-reliant, self-governing, and self-responsible. And this is something that I've really taken for granted, because while I've always, in the back of my mind, known this, it became really clear while doing this research that it's not the case in every culture. And this leads me to American culture. A source I was really drawn to was Claude S. Fisher's book, Made in America, A Social History of American Culture and Character. I'll link to it on the Facebook page. But he stresses that because of this individuality, America has a voluntaristic culture. I didn't know what that was. I looked it up. Voluntarism is the principle of relying on voluntary action. People assume they control their own fates and are responsible for themselves. in a voluntaristic culture, people are encouraged to examine and improve themselves, and their individuality is the key to their fortunes. So people strive for status. And he talks about traits that are used to describe Americans. They're kind of fun as an American to hear. Self-absorption, can-do, confidence, egalitarianism, conformism, and status striving. And he says that in the 18th century, visiting European aristocrats complained about the equality they saw in America.
Yeah, buddy. I mean, I guess that was 18th century, so things have changed, but...
European gentry no longer come over and are as disgusted, they have the good sense to keep it to themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
For many, adopting this voluntaristic culture has worked out. I was looking at historian David Potter, and he was saying Americans began as a people of plenty, but became even more so, and that over generations, more and more Americans who didn't used to have plenty now do. And security and goods has created a foundation for the expansion of middle-class American culture. So I'm saying all this, and I know that not everyone who immigrates to America achieves this American dream and the security and gets to be middle class. And I also know that a lot of people who originally came to this country did not come here voluntarily and have had a completely different experience, and that their children have had a very different experience than perhaps the immigrants who came wanting to come to America and wanting to be absorbed into American life. But basically, this is my brief explanation and look at America and why it might eat other cultures, as Neil Gaiman said. And hopefully it gives you a better idea of what he's kind of trying to encompass with this American God story.
Yeah.
Also, I think it's really interesting if you look at America from that lens. And we're not a political podcast, but there's so much politically going on.
Yeah.
And when you look at it as like this individualism and I take care of myself and I can do anything. Some things that I question about why people balk against, say, social programs make a lot more sense when you look at it from this perspective.
Yeah, that's true. That's definitely true. And it is, the thing is, though, with the whole idea of the American dream is it was originally set up for only white men.
Yes.
And the repercussions of that, I think, not to get too political, but we're feeling right now. And I've always found the antebellum period in American history, which is pre-Civil War, really fascinating, because that was the initial kind of experiment of what does an individualistic gentry sort of, or like European-founded country look like and function like that doesn't have a king, that has a semblance of a democracy, because it wasn't a real democracy. It's still not technically a real democracy by the very like literal sense of the word. And just how America excelled in that time period beyond any of Europe's imagination as far as like population boom and expansion west.
I mean, it was the great experiment.
Yeah, yeah.
America, doing this segment was really fun for me because U.S. history was my favorite course in high school and in college. And it felt like so comforting to come back to like just researching different time periods, which I didn't really include here.
Yeah.
And just American culture in general.
Yeah. James McPherson has a really great book on the antebellum period. And I forget what it's called, but I'll find it and link it on the Facebook page.
That'd
if
be
anyone's
great.
Interested in it.
Yeah.
Let's go on to production a little bit away from America. And we'll talk a little bit about Neil Gaiman, because he is pretty much first and mostly what I want to talk about in regards to this show.
Yeah. Kyle came in today and he's like, I didn't really do much research on the show creators. I just really like Neil Gaiman.
I just want to talk about Neil Gaiman. I've loved Neil Gaiman for a long time, and I feel like I've always loved Neil Gaiman, even though I'll get into it. So Neil Gaiman is a force. You know, he is one of the most peculiar forms of celebrity, and his path to said celebrity has been a really weird one, if you think about it. He's kind of like a literary rock star, but it goes beyond just writing books, because he has his hands in so many different projects. And has had for a while. I discovered Neil Gaiman when I was 15 years old, the summer after my freshman year of high school, when somehow American Gods came into my hands, and I still to this day don't remember how I received it. I think someone gave it to me, but I have no idea who that someone was. American Gods just seemed to have shown up one day, and upon its arrival, it pretended like it had been there always. Like, I always
brothers?
Had it. No, I was the first one in my family to read Neil Gaiman.
Okay.
I don't want to say got other brothers into Neil Gaiman because I don't think any of them are really into him in the way that I am. But I introduced my family to Neil Gaiman. I just don't know where I got it. It's almost like when I got American Gods, I can't remember ever not reading it. Like when after I read it, I remember like it stayed with me in a way that it's kind of colored the way I look at my life.
Yeah, it's one of those books where the ideas are so unique that you can't forget them.
Yeah.
Even if you don't remember the particulars, the overall themes are there.
And I think Neil Gaiman personally just has really impacted my life in a way that I didn't really recognize until I was doing the research for this podcast and remembering like, oh my gosh, my high school was just me obsessed with Neil Gaiman. And lucky for high school me, after I'd found American Gods, Neil Gaiman was and is prolific and had been since the 80s. So, like, once I found him, it was almost like a never-ending treasure trove of more stuff I could find by Neil Gaiman to kind of satisfy that appetite. So, like Claire mentioned before, Gaiman was born in England, and he started his career actually as a journalist, mostly writing book reviews and kind of author profile, stuff like that. And actually, there's a really funny quote from Kathy Acker, who was this like feminist punk poet and writer in the 80s and 90s, where they became friends, and she says to him, like, I'm really glad you made it. This is later. This is probably in the 90s. Like, I'm really glad you made it because, you know, I was worried there for a while. And he was like, well, I've always been a writer. And she was like, have you? Because I always thought of you as kind of a groupie.
Oh.
Just hanging out around all these authors that he loves and stuff. To me, she says something about how, to me, you were always just a groupie. I just thought that was funny. So Gaiman started writing outside of journalism in the mid-1980s. His first book published was a biography of Duran Duran, the band.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you might know them from Hungry Like the Wolf.
I know Duran Duran. Actually, I hate Duran Duran.
Do you?
I worked at a restaurant where they played their songs on repeat. And I know that they're fun songs. But
over and over.
Over and over. It just like is weird flashbacks. This is totally relevant to American
this
Gods.
This is very relevant to American Gods. Well, Duran Duran to me is unoffensive and I don't hate them.
And Hungry
Claire,
Like
so.
Wolves.
But it was actually in the comic medium that Gaiman would first find his major success. And this is how Gaiman kind of got into comics. Apparently in 1984, Gaiman was waiting for a train in London, and he saw a copy of Alan Moore's Swamp Thing, which is one of like the kind of one of the great comics that's held up as like, oh, the Alan Moore Swamp Thing has helped legitimize comics as a medium or an art form. And according to Gaiman, when he picked that up, that he says, quote, that was the final straw. What was left of my resistance crumbled. I proceeded to make regular and frequent visits to London's Forbidden Planet shop to buy comics. It kind of caved him in to start checking out more comics. So Gaiman started writing comics in the late 80s, and he impressed DC Comics with his early work, prompting them to hire him and run with his idea that he pitched, but they also were very into, to revive an old DC property from the 70s, The Sandman. And Gaiman's Sandman came out in 1989 and ran until 1996 and is one of the most pivotal works in comics ever, and it is frequently listed as an amazing work of literature just in general. It's often referred to as like a thinking man's comic. I heard it referenced as an intellectual's comic. But it really explored the comic genre in a way that it hadn't been done before. It won an amazing amount of Eisner Awards, 26.
I didn't even know there were 26 Eisner Awards.
And Eisner Awards are kind of like the Hugos for comics. They're like important comic book awards. And a recent prequel to it, which came out in 2016, won the Hugo for Best Graphic Story. And the Sandman comics, typically, they tend to follow Morpheus, the personification of dreams. And they are phenomenal. They are as good, if not better, than what everyone says.
To my great shame, I haven't read Sandman.
Don't you guys? You have it, don't you? Isn't it in where we are recording?
I don't think so. I would have read it.
Claire, your birthday's coming up. I know what to get you. It's honestly hard to find Sandman comics that aren't in these huge, very expensive omnibus editions anymore.
So, well, that's what I'm expecting, Kyle.
Okay, I'll buy you the big $400 Sandman omnibus. So that was from 89 to 96. But in the interim, while he was writing those comics, Gaiman was still working on other things. So in 1990, Gaiman and author Terry Pratchett wrote a novel together called Good Omens, and that was a comedy about the end of the world. In 1996, Gaiman wrote a novelization of his BBC miniseries, Neverwhere. I had no idea that Neverwhere was originally a BBC miniseries that Gaiman wrote and then turned into a novel.
Yeah, I found that out while doing this research as well.
And Neverwhere is one of my favorite Neil Gaiman books in general. So that was totally, I was like, what? I didn't even know this BBC series. It was like, I think I read it before the internet was really prevalent, so you didn't just know all this stuff when you look something up. And Neverwhere was an urban fantasy, kind of about the underground fantasy world of London, set in modern times. And that was in 1996. So in 1999, Gaiman published Stardust, which was an illustrated story, quote unquote. Think like, kind of like picture book for adults, except, you know, there's a ton of writing in it, you know, it's filled with prose, along with a straight novelization of said story.
That's one of my favorite books.
Oh, yeah.
Ever.
It's so good. And in 2001 was when Gaiman put out American Gods, and he calls that his first real novel. And that's the reason why I kind of went through all these novels beforehand, because he says his first novel, the one with Terry Pratchett, which actually technically wasn't his first novel, but his first fantasy novel, one with Terry Pratchett, Gaiman wasn't really an author yet and hadn't cut his teeth, so he claims Terry Pratchett did most of the work, and Terry Pratchett agreed. Terry Pratchett was like, yeah, you know, he was new, so a lot of the work on it fell to me. Neverwhere was adapted from a show that he had written, so he figures that's a little different. And then Stardust being an illustrated story, quote unquote, he just doesn't think it qualifies as his first novel ever.
What about the Duran Duran book?
Yeah, it was a biography. Is that a novel?
A novel.
It's not a novel. So Gaiman is British, like we mentioned, but he's been living in Wisconsin since 1992.
I didn't realize he lived in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
It makes a lot of sense for the setting of American Gods being in this, you know, the kind of American Midwest and kind of the, what we on the coast would snootily refer to as like kind of the nowhere of America. Ooh, Wisconsin, who cares?
We don't think that, or I don't.
I don't either. I don't think that either.
I haven't been to Wisconsin, but I've been to Michigan, and I love Michigan.
Yeah, I do love the Midwest states and the South because they're just fun to road trip in. I love these long stretches of highway, flat, and you can just drive, and there's something really therapeutic about it. And it's also, I kind of grew up doing a lot of that with my family, so it holds a special place for me for the Midwest. But there are a lot of people, we live in New York, who are a little down on the Midwest and the South. You know, and they have their reasons, but mostly I think
it's generalization. Yeah, I think a lot of it's people who haven't really been there.
But it helps explain the setting for American Gods, which are those quote-unquote flyover states. Gaiman would apparently take road trips using mostly back roads to find these small American towns to help inspire him for more of American Gods. One of those towns being Cairo, Illinois, which is a real place that he really went to and hung around for a bit to be like, oh, what could happen here? And it's a setting in the book, and I assume the show coming up soon. In regards to setting this book in those states, Gaiman has said, and this is from an interview by Rudy Dornman and Kelly Everdeen appearing on RainTaxi.com, that the reaction is sort of, gee, you're making those flyover states sound almost interesting. Who knew there was anything going on there? There's an awful lot going on in all of these places. It's another convenient fiction that life exists on the West Coast and life exists on the East Coast, and there's a little life in Texas. That you could take a map of America and sort of color in the places where there's life. What I was trying to say is that there is an incredible amount going on in these places, and it goes very deep, and it's very interesting and really cool. And I agree, Neil Gaiman, and I think your book really did help make it seem cooler to other people. Now, I honestly just want to keep yapping and yapping about Neil Gaiman. He's a cultural icon, and I think he'll be remembered as one of the greatest writers of the turn of the century. But I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about how how the show found its way to stars, because Gaiman has a storied history of books of his kind of being set up to maybe be a movie or be a show and then failing. But he also has a history of a lot of his books being made into successful movies, such as Stardust or Coraline. So it was in 2012 that it was announced that HBO was working on an American Gods TV show. But they were apparently never able to really get the script quite right. And that's been a problem with adapting American Gods from the get-go. I also read that Game of Thrones hadn't taken off in the way that it is now, and that maybe if they approached American Gods 3 years into Game of Thrones, they would have worked harder to make sure that this show got made. But because it was still in Game of Thrones' first year and it wasn't the cultural phenomenon that it is now, they were like, if we can't adapt it, we're having trouble, we're just going to let it go to the wayside.
I think it'd be a very hard thing to adapt.
I agree, and I think we'll get into that in the opinions. But apparently when Gaiman first wrote American Gods in 2001, he got a lot of calls from directors. He says, quote, "I would get calls from famous directors whom I'd actually heard of who would say, I want to turn this into a movie. And I'd say, great. And they'd say, but I can't figure out how you would do it because it's too long and too sprawling. And if you throw away that stuff that's long and sprawling, it wouldn't be American Gods anymore. And I'd say, this is true. And that would be the end of the conversation."
It's like they wanted him to tell them what should be cut.
Like how to do it. Yeah. And he was like, no, yeah, you really can't take any of that out. But Gaiman feels like he has the right team with showrunners Brian Fuller and Michael Green, who are running the show for Starz. Now, Fuller was the mastermind behind NBC's Hannibal, about the cannibalistic serial killer. And which I haven't seen, but it got good reviews.
Oh, people love Hannibal.
It got great reviews, but it had bad ratings, and it was canceled after 4 seasons. Whereas Green was one of the writers of this year's really hit movie, Logan, which we talked about.
We both really like.
Yeah, which is a really good movie. And he's a co-writer on it. I don't know how much of that script he wrote, but I think it's a great script. It paces really well, and it's a cool movie. And we have a podcast on that. If you're interested, check it out. Green also has script writing credit for the new Ridley Scott Alien Covenant, which I will sadly go to see in theaters.
It's doing well.
It's doing well. That's good. I never have hope for Ridley Scott Alien movies since Prometheus. By never, I mean, you know, just the two, I guess. And for this year's, or this fall's Blade Runner sequel, Blade Runner 2049.
That's another thing you're not excited about.
No, I am excited about Blade Runner 2049. Okay. Because that's
Kyle doesn't like Blade Runner.
I don't like Ridley Scott, and he did the first Blade Runner. Oh. But Blade Runner 2049 is Denis Villeneuve, who we also talked about in a podcast, and our Arrival episode. And I really enjoyed Arrival, so I'm pumped for that. As of now, American Gods has had 3 episodes released and has already been renewed for a second season, so there's going to be more. It has gotten rave reviews and has a 95% critic score and an 83% audience score on Rotten Tomatoes, which we'll get into opinions now, honestly kind of shocks me.
Me too. That critic score blows my mind.
Yeah. Because I don't hate this show, but I'm really not sold on it yet.
I feel like the reviews that I read too, granted were not a lot, but a lot of them were saying it's really ambitious and I'm interested to see where it's going.
That
doesn't sound like a 95%.
Yeah, like a 95%.
That doesn't sound like a solid A.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds like a, jury's still out on this. You know.
Finish your report and then I'll tell you what I think. So what do you think of the show, Kyle?
There are definitely things I like about it. There are things I don't like about it. I think the third episode, which we just watched, is the best one I've seen so far.
I agree.
I think, what's his name? Ricky Whittle. I think has the hardest job in the show and does the best job. He plays Shadow. He plays the main character. And I think that's the hardest part to play in this because Shadow in the books he's such a non-entity in a lot of ways. And Whittle really brings him to
Whittle
life in a cool
way.
Whittle
has to say some stupid dialogue.
Yeah,
he
I
just
know. That's another thing.
He has to say what Shadow is thinking in the book.
Yeah.
Because it's important to the plot.
Yeah.
But in the book, you get to hear Shadow's thoughts.
Yeah.
So he just has to speak Shadow's thoughts.
Yeah.
For no good reason.
And my goodness, does he do a damn fine job at it, I think.
He's very handsome, and that helps, too.
He's also very handsome, yes. And Ian McShane is great, too. He's just fun and charismatic to watch.
I love Ian McShane. Deadwood. He's amazing, and I remember watching him there and just, who is this and how is he so talented? But I think that they haven't quite figured out how to use him, and they kind of started working it out in the third episode. But he's so talented, and he has this ability to just deliver text, even if it's about nothing, in a very interesting way. So I feel like they just give him text, but the text doesn't always seem to need to be there or have a ton of meaning behind it.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, he's very charismatic as an actor, and I feel like both these actors, Whittle and McShane, are elevating the script to be better than it is.
It is. And I was so excited when I found out Ian McShane was going to play Mr. Wednesday they found one of the best people play it. And I think they think that too, so they don't think they have to work
as hard. Yeah, the
I mean, what do I know? I'm not adapting this show.
Yeah, no, that's true.
This book, I should say, and it's a hard book.
And Gaiman is an executive producer on the show and has a lot of creative input. So I don't know. Maybe it's one of those things where I hold that book, the book, to such high esteem that I'm afraid everything I'm going to see on screen is going to be a little disappointing. I don't hate it. I'm still with it. But there are parts that just...
There are parts that I do hate.
Yeah, there are parts that I do hate. What's something that you really disliked in the show?
So in the show, they do these coming to America stories where it shows immigrants coming to America and bringing their god or gods.
Gods, yeah.
And those are the best part of the book. I think the book itself, American Gods, is uneven. And it's like you said, it sticks with you. And I'm really happy I read it. And I'm really happy I reread it for this episode. But I don't think it's Gaiman's best work. I think Anansi Boys, his follow-up,
yeah,
is actually
Anansi Boys,
a better book. Great. And it makes sense that it's his first quote-unquote novel.
Real novel, yeah.
But anyway, but those Coming to America stories are so good. And they do not do those stories justice, except in the third episode, they did. And I know I am one of those people that I kind of hate in myself where I'm like, well, it's not like the book.
Yeah.
But here's my thing. In those Coming to America stories, after every single one of them, I was left with so much feeling and so much emotion.
In the book, when you read
in
them in the
book. Oh, my goodness. There's in the second episode, they do slaves being brought over to to America.
On a
Dutch ship. And Gaiman has a chapter about a brother and sister who were brought over as slaves to America.
Yeah.
And after I finished reading that brother and sister story in Gaiman's book, it just left me. Like, I could get emotional talking about it right now, just bleak and sad and just rethinking America and what people did to other people and how horrible it is. It's kind of the same feeling after watching 12 Years a Slave, where you actually start facing, well, I guess you're not personally facing it, but you're coming to grips with your country's horrid past.
With the hypocrisy of this, like, anyone can do anything in America, but like, no. Yeah.
Like people who were brought here against their will and under horrible circumstances. And you don't have to tell the same story.
Yeah.
That's a hard story to tell because it takes place over their whole lives. On the other hand, what they did, they had Anansi deliver a monologue to a bunch of slaves and then burn down the ship they're on. It was not the same, and it did not evoke the same feeling or make you think about America in the same way that Neil Gaiman did.
Yeah, I agree. That was and I've read a lot of things about that monologue, how people really love it.
I don't get it.
Didn't hit home for me. I'm also like, I'm not black in America, so I'm not feeling the same feelings as other people. But you're right. And for me, in the story, in the book, when they tell that story, it's a lot more evocative of emotions and sadness.
Yeah. And also, there's a Viking story in the first episode,
which was done poorly.
It's done so poorly. And that, I think, could have been a fairly easy thing to adapt.
I agree.
And that also made me feel feelings, not in the same way. That slave story is one of the most powerful things I've ever read.
Yeah.
But it made me feel things.
Yeah. There's and that's the thing about Neil Gaiman's book, American Gods, is to me it's almost like a collection of short stories of Shadow's kind of adventures in different small towns in America or in some cities, you know, Shadow in Chicago, you know, with these kind of Polish Slavic gods, Shadow in Cairo, Illinois, maybe with some Egyptian gods, you know, like Shadow over here, Shadow over there. And they all kind of exist pretty well as their own little stories. And there's an overarching plot beyond that. But
it's an exploration of America in a very cool, different way. And I think the show is capturing some of that. Like I said earlier, they're eating at American diners. They're staying at these seedy American home motels. And Mr. Wednesday's enjoying all of it. And Shadow's just kind of along for the ride.
But I remember feeling bad for Shadow reading the book. But watching the show and seeing what happens to him, and the way that Whittle delivers it, too, it's like, oh, man, poor Shadow. he's a good guy just trying to do the right thing or just stay out of trouble, and just so much crap happens to him.
Right. Actually, I feel like he's more of an accomplice in the book than he has been so far in the TV show.
Yeah.
Which I'm okay. That's fine by me.
Yeah.
I also, I know people love Hannibal, and they love these showrunners, but I am kind of not into the slow motion and the violence. It feels very, oh my gosh, Zack Snyder.
Yeah, it does feel
and
a
maybe
Zack Snyder
I just have this like gut reaction to anything Zack Snyder-esque yeah. after Batman v Superman. But the violence is so extreme and a lot of times I think super uncalled for. It doesn't heighten the story in any
way. No, that's, yeah. And I agree with you a lot with that. And that's where the whole Weiss and Benioff, who are the creators from Game of Thrones, come in my mind in comparison to Fuller and Greene, who are the showrunners for American Gods. And that I do like Game of Thrones, but I think Weiss and Benioff are kind of creepy. And I think that they put a lot of creepy stuff into their show for shock value.
I think they're doing a better job adapting books.
Even so, that's like I can agree with you there, but just some of the stuff they put into Game of Thrones for shock value, I see that yeah. echoed in American Gods with Fuller and Greene, yeah.
And I feel like they're so into their like fancy slow motion shots that it's actually taking away from the story and not adding it. I get these are gods, and so maybe one or two really cool ones is necessary.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know. I also wonder, we have read that book, and our producers read that book, and the only person I know who's watching the show who hasn't read the book has no idea what's going on and stopped watching. He's like, I just don't get it. I don't understand what's happening.
You know, I was talking to James about this, our producer, and he was saying that if you haven't read the book, I don't think the show is made for you because you wouldn't know what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a choice.
Yeah.
But how many people have read the book because you're really going for that niche audience.
Yeah, no, that's true. And that is something that Starz is doing, going for niche audiences. We talked about this in our Ash vs. Evil Dead podcast, which so far in my mind, Ash vs. Evil Dead is a better show than
I don't like horror, and I think Ash vs. Evil Dead is a better show.
But I want to switch gears a little bit off the show, Claire, and just ask you what your favorite Neil Gaiman work is.
I said Stardust.
Stardust?
Yeah.
100%?
100%. I feel like it was made for me. For those who don't know, Stardust is a fairy tale for adults. You said it earlier.
It's a fairy story. Yeah, yeah. It's an illustrated fairy story.
About a fallen star.
Yeah. It's pretty cute, but it's also brutal at times.
It's brutal and cute. I think as someone who grew up loving fairy tales and fantasy.
And fae and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. It's taking all of that to another level in an adult sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's beautiful and amazing.
And there's a cute movie. The movie's nowhere near as good as the book, but the movie is cute. The Stardust movie.
I didn't want to watch the movie because I love the book so much.
Yeah.
But I think I should. I've heard really good things about it.
It's not the book in the way that they can't explore and flesh everything out that they could in that book. But it's adorable. Claire Danes is in it and Robert De Niro is in it and it's
the
great.
Tone seemed too lighthearted to me.
Yeah, that's the thing. It is a lighthearted kind of like PG-13 middle school movie. And the book, it gets pretty dark.
The book is PG-13, but it's a Zack Snyder PG-13.
No, that's not a Zack
Snyder. No, it's Christopher Nolan
PG-13. PG-13, exactly.
What's your favorite, Kyle?
My favorite Neil Gaiman thing, because he's done a lot of things, from writing TV shows, movies, books, is Ocean at the End of the Lane, which started as a short story for Neil Gaiman, but it exploded and he wrote more and more and more and it turned into a short little like novella maybe or is it?
Novella. What's Ocean at the End of the Lane about for those who don't know, Kyle?
Ocean at the End of the Lane is about a man who you never find out his name, but he comes back home to his old neighborhood for a funeral and it kind of explores him remembering childhood events and it's fascinating and it is a fantasy book, but it's a fantasy book in that Neil Gaiman way where it's very like contemplative and it doesn't feel like a Lord of the Rings book, you know.
It deals with being a child
very, very well. And my close second to that is Fragile Things, which is one of his short story collections. I think that's one of the best things ever made. Every short story in there is gold, and I've bought that book 4 times because I lend it out so readily to people to be like, you gotta read this. That I just keep buying it over and over again because I never get it back.
Because people like it so much.
Maybe they like it so much, or maybe I'm so in love with it in a way that I force it on people and are like, you have to read it. And they like, okay, and then they forget about it.
And then they never get to it, and they feel guilty, so they don't give it to you.
And actually, you know what? I take it back. Fragile Things is my number one video game.
That's news to me. I always thought it was Ocean at the End of the Lane.
Yeah, I was thinking about it today when I was doing this work and thinking about how much Neil Gaiman I've read, and I thought I'd read a lot, and I have, but there's so much. He's written so much and he's done so much. It's like, oh, wow.
I feel like I've read a lot of Neil Gaiman, but I haven't.
But he haven't, yeah, because he's been doing this for so long.
I didn't realize it had been that long.
Yeah, 1989, Sandman.
Oh, good for him.
So I don't know, American Gods. I'm going to stick with it.
I'm going to stick with it, too. If you've read the book, I think it's worth watching the series. It's beautiful. I mean, for all of my dissing on the slow motion,
yeah,
it's a beautiful show. And yeah. I think that they get the Americana, exploring America.
Exploring small town Midwest, kind of forgotten America, yeah.
Yeah, and I think they're just struggling to find their voice, in all honesty, is what it is, and how to tell this really huge, sprawling story that Neil Gaiman's wrote.
Yeah.
Written.
I'm curious to see where the show goes, and I'm going to stick with it because I hold the book to such high esteem.
Yeah, and I hope that the Coming to America stories in the show are, from now on, as good as they were in the third episode.
Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com, and we would love it if you can rate and review us on iTunes. We would love it almost as much as I love Fragile Things, but not quite.
That's high praise.
It is. We like ratings and reviews. You can find the show on Twitter at DSRA Podcast, and I can be found on Twitter at Klex303. That's KLEX303.
I can be found at Along with Claire. That's CLAIRE.
And you can find our producer, James, at James Fowey Jr. That's James Fowey, FOUHEYJR.
And Kyle, I'm so sorry I didn't say this earlier. It's really great to have you back. You reading the credits made me think I'm kind of relieved not to have to do them this
week.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's great to be back, Claire.
Yeah, not on a boat.
Not on a boat in Annapolis.
In this sweltering hot booth in sweltering hot New York City.
I know, but my boat adventure was much different from this.
I can imagine.
But thank you. And your episode on Guardians of the Galaxy was awesome. I just want to say you and even James was good. Which
that's very high praise.
I know.
You're just doling it out today.
Doling it out today. It's because I feel very generous. You can learn more about American Gods on our Facebook page, where we're going to post some of our show notes and the books that we mentioned. I'm going to try and find that McPherson novel on America.
Ooh, and I'm going to post my 2014 census information from the Atlantic.
And I'm going to show you that Montgomery County in Maryland is really the most diverse place in the U.S. Anyway, our producer, who sees himself as the god of American exceptionalism, is James Fowey. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, who is in a constant battle with a kind of Loki-esque character every day of her life. And, you know, we really should all pray for or at Patty Hyland that she gets more powerful to handle that. And our theme was composed by Pete Rowan, the American god of the catchiest theme songs known to America or gods. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you in 2 weeks.